Okay, hand me this.
Roll the trumpet.
Yeah, roll sound ahead.
Hello, I'm Pete Conrad, commander of Apollo 12. We'd like to welcome you all to NASA's Kennedy Space Center, and thanks for coming. We appreciate you taking time out to see us off on the first leg of this exciting moon landing mission. Sorry we can't be here in person to fill you in on the details of the Apollo 12 flight plan, but as you can well imagine, things are pretty busy for the crew during these final hours before launch. Once more, thanks for being here. I hope the launch will be as exciting for you as I know it's going to be for the three of us. Now on with the briefing. We'll turn things over to a teammate of ours, the Lunar Module pilot for the flight of Spider and Gumdrop last March, astronaut Russell L. Schweikart. Rusty, it's all yours.
Cut. Roll sound, roll camera.
Hi, I'm Pete Conrad, commander of Apollo 12.
Do it once more without the high.
Okay. I'm Pete Conrad. Forget it. I'm Pete Conrad, commander of Apollo 12.
Fine, now we've got both directions. We can use either one. Okay. Inform them or the form, whichever they want. Now, we're ready to roll right into a biographical thing.
Pete, it's been several years since you flew in Gemini 11. You also flew in Gemini 5. This will be your third time in space. What's your reaction to a voyage as ambitious as this?
Well, of course, I'm looking forward to it very much. This is what we've all been working for the last 7 years, really. The Gemini flights were preludes to this, and as you remember, Gemini 5, we had the objective to stay 8 days, which was the minimum lunar trip. And of course, on 11, we did the M=1 rendezvous, which is part of learning how to do the rendezvous around the moon that we've worked out and developed, and the rest of the guys have all done. So I'm looking forward to it with not so much anticipation from the fact that it's exciting, but it's sort of the culmination of 7 years' worth of work.
Well, let's discuss you just a bit here. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And did you get your early education there?
Yes, I went to Haverford School in Haverford, Pennsylvania for 11 years, and I graduated from a boarding school up in New England near Albany, New York, called the Darrow School. And then I went to Princeton University on a Navy scholarship and took aeronautical engineering.
And that's how you got into the Navy and into flying, I presume?
Right. I went right straight from graduation to flight training in the Navy and spent almost 4 years in a fighter squadron in Jacksonville, Florida. Then I went to the Navy's test pilot school in 1958. That's getting a while back. I have to scratch over the numbers. And spent a year in armament test there and went back to the school as a performance instructor and to teach other Navy pilots how to be test pilots. And from there, I went to the West Coast and was in one of the first Phantom squadrons on the West Coast. And at that time, I was accepted in NASA as an astronaut and September of 1962, and I've been here ever since.
And you've been an astronaut for 7 years?
Just a little over 7 years, yeah.
Is your wife from the Philadelphia area?
No, she's from Texas. She was born in San Antonio, Texas, and her folks live in Uvalde, Texas, which is about 300 miles from Houston here, and so we go out there quite often. Her father's a rancher, and I think my children like that a lot better than their father because they have a grandfather that's a real cowboy. And it's a lot more exciting than what I do as far as they're concerned, I think.
How many children do you have?
I have four boys.
Four boys? Oh, boy. They are probably little cowboys at this
point. Yes, all of them are.
All of them. What ages?
They're 8, 10, 12, and 14.
Are they more interested in being cowboys than possibly future astronauts?
Well, all four of them, like boys, are different, and some of them are interested in flying right now, and some of them are not. I have three playing football right at the moment, and one that's not, so of course they are old enough to be very interested in sports and this sort of thing right now, and they do build models, and one of them is very interested in gas model airplanes and so forth, like I was. But certainly they are individuals and they have different interests.
Pete, I know that your family is going to be pulling for you in a big way. You got a good rooting team here on Earth while you're gone on Apollo 12.
Yeah, I think so. And the boys are going to come to the Cape, see the launch.
Ah, good. They're going to watch it. Wonderful. Good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, keep rolling. Pete, would you describe the overall mission of Apollo 12?
Well, I think the overall mission of Apollo 12 is starting a second generation of flights. We've worked very diligently to achieve a lunar landing in the time frame that we set out. And Apollos 12 through 20 now have the job of exploring the moon. And our flight, I think, is the first attempt at that. To utilize the whole flight for that. We've spent the majority of our training time on the lunar surface operation with respect to the scientific accomplishments that are called out to be done on that flight, deploy the ALSAP package and do the detailed lunar geology. It was sort of the object of Apollo 11 to successfully work out the landing and ascent procedures as the last part of the package that we worked on through Apollo 7 through 11. And of course, I can't remember the number right now, but we are shifting over later on in the Apollo series to a 3-day LEM, which will allow us even longer useful lunar exploration. One of the other interesting things right now, we feel that we have worked out our 32-hour lunar stay time to utilize the maximum that we have of that time to spend on the lunar surface, which is right now fixed at 7 hours, and it may be open-ended longer than that in real time. I think it's interesting that a lot of our time in doing that is spent getting ready to get out for the time period, and the amount of time that we spend cleaning up after we come back in, and then we have to go through the same cycle to get back out again. And one of the other things which we hope to find out if we do open-end our timeline is, and I think that it's going to turn out this way, that it's probably better to get man all dressed and get him out on the lunar surface for what you would consider like a normal working day. Get him outside and let him stay out for 7 or 8 hours. Now, to do that, along with this, and I think to utilize the time most effectively in exploring the lunar surface, we need on the 3-day LEMs to also develop the life support system, which will allow us to stay out for the amount of time like 6 or 7 hours.
Mm-hmm. And you consider Apollo 12 a step in the direction of these developments you're discussing?
Yes, well, I consider it twofold. We're really doing, we should always be looking to the future. And also, in that sense, I think that our timeline and our EVA and what we accomplish in it will be an indicator of what we can do in the future when we have the longer stay LEMs. And of course, the other thing, which is the most important thing in the object, is to do the experiments in their order of priority, which is the ALSAP first. And for those that are not familiar with it, that's a package that will have a nuclear generating source of electrical power that will run 4 experiments for a year after we leave and transmit that data in real time back to Earth during that year whenever the scientists want to look at it. Mm-hmm. They do have the ability to turn it on and off. And so it should run and send data back on our landing site for at least a year after we leave. And of course the other part is to do this detailed sampling of the lunar surface and bring back as many rocks that are detailed in the proper manner, and we've spent a great deal of time working on these procedures to get the proper photographs and the to tie the rocks into the proper context from which they came and so forth, and that's pretty much really the difference between 12 and 11. We really are looking for this useful work period on the moon. That's what we're going for.
What do you think is the most important thing that you have gained from 11 for use in your flight?
I think the most important thing that we gained from 11 was we were working on this flight prior to the time 11 landed, and I made an assumption that their simulations of the lunar surface operations and that their input into making the landing, the procedures for making the landing and the ascent would be good enough based on their homework and from what we observed of their lunar surface operations and from what they told us, that we wouldn't have to change any of the things that we were doing. In other words, I built our whole lunar surface plan around a successful Apollo 11. And as it turned out, Apollo 11 was successful both in the landing and in the lunar surface operation. At least man got out. We didn't have the apparent fatigue problems that we had in the early Gemini EVAs, which said we learned our homework, our simulations were good. It looked to us that while we were doing our simulations, the lunar surface work in 11 was, that we weren't going to have any problems, but we'd been bitten a few times before, so we were a little suspicious. And I can remember sitting in a control center watching them do the experiments that they were doing and that I was very, very familiar with, and seeing that it went so well that I was very excited that night in the fact that it was going to make no change to all the work we had done up to that time.
Really confidence in your own procedure.
Very, very good, yeah. That was very reassuring.
Good luck in carrying them on.
Thank you.
Okay, halt and let's reboot.
Roll slate.
Pete, one of your most ambitious undertakings during your excursion of the moon will hopefully be to find the Surveyor 3 spacecraft. How do you plan to go about this?
Do you mean how do we plan to make the spot landing, or what we're going to do with it if we find it?
Let's take both cases.
Well, we have analyzed the errors from Apollo 11 and tried to incorporate this knowledge into our procedures so that we don't have these downrange errors that were apparent there. And we've changed the computer program so that we can update the targeting late in the flight. When they see the errors after DOI that are always inherent, you're bound to have some errors, to clean up our targeting and our navigation. Now, also, when we pitch over at 7,000 feet, I hope to be able to have enough knowledge of the terrain from the photographs that are being provided of us when we're going in there to recognize right away whether we're off in cross range or down range, and I have two manners of I can either go automatically to the computer and change the targeted landing site, or I can manually fly over there. And we probably plan to do a little bit of both, mm-hmm. If all goes well.
Well, once you get there, and hopefully into Pete's Park, as we're hearing it called, how would this traverse by you and Bean into the crater where Surveyor is located be carried out?
Well, there are two possibilities, and the first one is that we do land close enough that it's really right at hand. When I say right at hand, within 300 or 400 feet, then there's the possibility that for some reason or another it is close enough for us to walk to, but it's not readily at hand. It's say 2,000, 2,500 feet. In the latter case, we would plan our geology traverse so that at some point in that traverse we would wind up at the Surveyor, and in other words, that's the most efficient way to utilize the time, and just walking to it would be to do this documented sample en route to the Surveyor, mm-hmm. and back from it. And of course the other is we can run a traverse anywhere we want to and come back to the spacecraft, leave the rocks, and then just wander over to the Surveyor, which says we landed very, very close to it. In either event, when we get there, I have a set of cutters that will be on the back of my Pliss that Al put on there that are carried on the external package that we carry equipment on, the Mesa.
Is this a hand-cutting tool?
Yes, it's a large set of bolt cutters is what it amounts to. And we have a bag. And aside from the photographic information that we should bring back about the Surveyor, and Al is going to take the photographs, one of the most interesting things would be the photographs taken very close to the same position that the TV camera took the close photographs, and then people would have these two photographs to compare 31 months apart see the effects of what happens to the lunar surface over 31 months. The other thing which would be interesting, and we have four items which we're going to try and retrieve off the surveyor with the bolt cutters, and that is, we don't need the bolt cutters for the glass, but there's some thermal glass that was mounted on it as a thermal shield, and this glass has been sitting out for 31 months exposed to micrometeorites, and we can bring the glass back for him to examine. And the other thing that would be interesting would be a polished aluminum tube, which is relatively easy to cut off, which also has been exposed both to micrometeorites and the solar wind, and would be a useful bit of information to bring back, sort of a 31-month-long solar wind experiment. And then there is the TV camera that is mounted on there that has some cabling to it. Now, they would like us to cut a sample of the cable off and put it in a organically pure container and bring it back, excuse me, which would allow the organic scientists to see what happened to the Earth's bacteria and that has been carried out on it. Mm-hmm. It was not completely clean when it left the Earth. And the last thing is the TV camera, which is a multitude of different kinds of parts. It's got electronic parts in it. It has various metals that are painted, anodized, not coated, insulation, just all kinds of materials that are essential to building space vehicles. By bringing back that TV camera for analysis, the engineers would get a very good handle on the effects of long-duration exposure to the space environment on materials, and would crank this into, obviously, later designs of both unmanned and manned satellites that you want to stay up and operate for a long time. So these are the bonus benefits that we'd get by making a spot landing next to the surveyor.
Good luck. I hope you can pull off this ambitious undertaking.
Thank you.
I want you to describe PDI to touchdown, just in your own words.
Okay.
Okay, shut the door. We've got to roll. We're still rolling. Pete, would you describe the events from powered descent to touchdown, how you will be piloting the limb down to the surface?
All right. We are doing several things differently. If you remember, we had some communications problems on 11. Because they went in face down. Now, we're going to start power descent face up. And, of course, 26 seconds after the engine lights at 10% thrust, we throttle up to 100% thrust and we're face up.
In other words, you prefer to come in by instruments rather than being able to see the surface, right?
Well, we have the reason that they came in face down was two reasons. One, to run an altitude check. By visual observance of features moving through a known angle for time, and also to give them some idea of their downtrack error. Now, it's essential that we maintain good communications because we're going to get our downtrack error information from relayed from the Earth based on their analysis at startup of the engine at PDI initiate by looking at what we call this LIRA processor. And at 2 minutes into the burn, the ground is going to relay up what their best estimate is of the change in our landing site, and we're going to input that into our computer during the burn, which is a change. Now, I mentioned the altitude business. There's another way to determine your altitude at PDI with the rendezvous radar tracking the command module, and we're going to adopt that procedure rather than the visual observance. We feel that that's probably a more accurate check anyhow. So it's really not a question of going in by instruments. It's really a question of doing it by a different means. Now, we will also be able to observe the lunar surface by going inertially to the burn attitude right after DOI. We're actually heads down going forward in orbit at that portion of the moon right after the burn. So we'll see the lunar horizon in front of us go down through the window and disappear as our inertial attitude leaves us in the local horizontal position to the moon at the start of the burn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mentioned that at 2 minutes into the burn, we would input this information about the downrange error if it's there. And we do expect to see some, and so we expect to update the computer at 2 minutes into the burn. About 4 minutes into the burn, we should pick up our radar data. and start updating the computer with the radar information. And then the next thing that we look for is throttle down of the big engine, and that comes at some 6 minutes and 40 some seconds into the flight. We get throttle down, and around 8 minutes into the burn we should be approaching the high gate position, which is about 7,300 feet, and right after that we get the pitch over and start the targeting for the low gate conditions, which is the hover point right over the landing site. And that's the point where I hope to start looking to see where we are and make the determination visually whether we're short or cross range, and either fly manually or input to the computer through the stick some changes in the landing site in order to get over to where the surveyor is.
Now you have more, a bit more fuel capability and maneuvering capability during that final moment or
well,
so.
Well, we
this
really
time, haven't you?
Don't have any more fuel, but we have changed the trajectory to use that fuel, I think, a little better than on 11. Now, we picked the trajectory on 11 to make it very optimum for pilot takeover just to achieve a landing. Now, I've accepted some things that we would normally, having never done it before, not wanted to do. But now that we've done it, and I've spent a great deal of time talking to Neil, both spent a lot of time flying the LLTV, things like that, that it does not look bad to us to accept this other thing, which is a little higher sink rate, about 2 feet per second more at 500 feet than we had on Neil's trajectory. And this slight change there and a little greater horizontal velocity at 500 feet gives us a little more fuel to fly around manually. It's about 20 seconds worth, I think, all told. Plus, this limb is a lighter limb.
Well, the whole world will be listening very carefully with you, Pete, as you park that in your lot there. We hope that you get right on the spot you're headed for.
Thank you.
Good luck.